when I came into the battalion, I told the existing S1 that I'd like to be the S1 when my field tour was completed. And he said to me, well, if you survive your tour, we'll make you the S1 because you'll be coming out of the field about the same time I'll be going home. The life expectancy for a first lieutenant in Vietnam was 90 days. And I survived my tour. The other officers who accompanied me on that same day, there were four of us that went in to see the battalion commander. The other three didn't make it. They were wounded or they were killed.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. Hey, everyone, and thank you so much for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Today, our guest is Robin Bartlett. Robin came from a military family, including several West Point attendees. Amid the Vietnam War and draft, he joined college ROTC and later became a distinguished military graduate, pursued infantry, airborne, and ranger training, and served in the 82nd Airborne Division. As a combat infantry platoon leader, he deployed a 32-man platoon on search and destroy missions and helicopter assaults into hot landing zones at the height of the Vietnam War, and now spends his time speaking about those experiences and is the author of the book Vietnam Combat Firefights and Writing History. Robin, I am so excited to have you on today. I have so much respect for those who came before me as a service member myself. So thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Well, I'm happy to join and tell my story, which does not end here.
Awesome. Well, Robin, I'm going to pass it off to you then to share a little bit more about yourself and a little bit of your background with the audience.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm an ROTC graduate. From a military family, my grandfather went to West Point, my father went to West Point, my brother went to West Point. But when it came time for me to start college, my father said, well, I'll get you an appointment to West Point. I said, nope, that is not what I want to do. I went to 13 elementary and middle schools and four different high schools. And I said, I have had enough traveling around this country and world. I want to go to one college and just stay there the whole time. I want nothing to do with the military. But it was 1963, and then I graduated in 67, and that was the height of the Vietnam War. It was really building at that point in time, tremendous draft, and it built up to 500,000 soldiers in Vietnam at that point in time. So I did not wish to be drafted, and I decided I really had to serve my obligation as an officer because all my family members were officers. So I went through the ROTC program. And then at the ripe age of 21, with a college degree, knowing everything that could be known, right? Just terribly smart. I went to a small liberal arts college in Southern California. I decided I would challenge myself with the most challenging thing that I could think of, and that was to volunteer for infantry, airborne, ranger, and assignment to the 82nd Airborne Division, which is a very proud airborne unit. And I got everything I volunteered for, plus a little bit more, and served, went through training at Fort Benning, Georgia, now called Fort Liberty. They've changed all the names, and went through ranger school, jump school, infantry basic training. And I'll just mention very briefly that ranger school was the most arduous training that I have ever gone through, both mentally and physically demanding. The whole object of that training is to take you to the point of exhaustion, both physical and mental. And when you reach, and also if you didn't make your objective, they didn't feed you. So I lost about 25 pounds in ranger school. But at that point, when you reach total mental and physical exhaustion, that's where they test you. And they say, okay, you are now the leader, take over. And that training turned out to be the best insurance policy that an officer could have in Vietnam, and certainly was helped me tremendously, gave me a tremendous sense of confidence and ability to handle every situation. Didn't mean that I was fearless, but it did give me a great sense of confidence. So I was with the 82nd Airborne Division for about 9 months and then received orders to go to Vietnam. And they wanted to keep airborne officers in airborne units. So originally I was to go to the 101st Airborne Division. But when I arrived in Vietnam, it was right after the Tet Offensive of 1968. That was the big Tet Offensive, and also pretty much the psychological turning point of the war, because up to that point in time, America thought we were winning the war. And after that Tet Offensive, there had been so many American casualties, even though the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese casualties were 10 times what the American casualties were, but it changed the popular opinion of the war. That was the actual turning point, psychological turning point of the American public. And the protests went forward at a greater rate after that Tet Offensive. But what happened to me when I got there was they said, forget it, you're no longer going to the 101st Airborne Division. We'll let you know where to go. And I ended up being assigned to the 1st Cav Division, 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile. And that turned out to be a really, in many respects, a great assignment, because that division had more helicopters. The whole concept behind the Air Mobile Division was that they brought fresh troops to the battle by helicopter, as opposed to having to march to the battle. So it allowed us to carry more water and more ammunition and lighter packs. For example, my pack weighed about 45 pounds, whereas other officers in other divisions carried packs that weighed maybe 70, 75 pounds. I was able to carry more ammunition, more water, and had access to, of course, to helicopters, Cobra helicopters, more artillery, even jets with napalm, and occasionally even battleships firing offshore. So I worked my way up to the area of operations of the 1st Cav. At that point in time was along the demilitarized zone, which was Gulf of Tonkin on the east coast and the Laotian border on the west coast. So the terrain dictated a lot of the strategy and tactics that we followed. So if you were out by the Gulf of Tonkin, you had tumbleweed and sand and no overhead cover, average temperature of 105 to 115 degrees. And then as you progressed to the west toward the Laotian border, you got into hills and mountains and three canopies jungle, which means there was three layers of growth over your head and very, very thick. You had to cut your way with machetes. And our tactic was search and destroy, meaning we were in a free fire zone. Anything that we encountered, we were allowed to shoot. There were no friendlies, in other words, in our area. And our mission was to find the enemy and engage him, and then bring all the resources that I mentioned to bear: artillery, helicopter gunships, Cobra helicopters, jets, the whole nine yards. So that kind of gives you a quick, not so quick, but it gives you an overview of what it was like. And you mentioned 32 men. That was the high number. Normally I had about 26 to 28 based upon replacements and men being wounded or going on R&R or getting sick, whatever. I had to be very, very cautious about heat within those temperatures. And when you got into the Laotian area toward the Laotian border, the humidity was intense. So you could go through 2 gallons of water by noon. And we had to be very cautious of men just keeling over from heat stroke or heat exhaustion. it was a real very important thing to take breaks and drink as much water as you could.
Yeah, so you bring up several things that as a leader, you obviously had to be thinking about so many different things at one time. I'm curious, in that time frame when you're on search and destroy missions, I'm sure there were a number of guys in your unit that were just terrified at certain points. And this is just me as assuming based off of human nature. But I also know that you had really good training up until that point, too. How, as a leader, do you handle the emotions of 28 to 32 guys that you're leading, also while handling your emotions, also while remembering all these things of, oh, we got to take breaks, we have to make sure we drink enough water, and all the training to make sure that you're staying safe? Talk us through that.
Well, I did a couple of things that helped me on my tour. When I was first introduced to my battalion, my secondary specialty was as the battalion adjutant, or S1. That's the personnel officer. So when I came into the battalion, I told the existing S1 that I'd like to be the S1 when my field tour was completed. And he said to me, well, if you survive your tour, we'll make you the S1, because you'll be coming out of the field about the same time I'll be going home. The life expectancy for a first lieutenant in Vietnam was 90 days. And I survived my tour. The other officers who accompanied me on that same day, there were four of us that went in to see the battalion commander. The other three didn't make it. They were wounded or they were killed. And I attribute the fact that I survived, even though I was wounded, that I survived to doing three things. Number one, I tried not to do stupid stuff. That was most important. Number two, I met with my platoon sergeant and my squad leaders, and I sat down with them and I said, listen, I'm the new guy. You have more experience. I'm still the leader, but I want you, if you see me doing something wrong, I want you to tell me. And I want your guidance. I want your advice. And number three, and this may have been one of the things that made my soldiers have a higher degree of confidence. And that was something called reconnaissance by fire, meaning as my point man started to move into an area, and you had to trust the instincts of your point man. You had to trust the instincts of the man at the front of the line. And going through the jungle, it was all single file. And if they felt uncomfortable, if they didn't hear birds singing, if they didn't hear monkeys chirping, if it was quiet or whatever that instinct might have been, I called in artillery fire in front of us. And that was called reconnaissance by fire. And I shot an awful lot of artillery out in front of us so that when we walked through the area, we had already pretty well blown it away. In fact, I shot so much artillery that they got to know my call sign. And they put a budget on me of 25 rounds. That's all I could shoot at one time for reconnaissance by fire. That made my soldiers, the men in my unit, feel more confident about walking into an area. And there were a couple of times when that proved to be a very smart thing to have done.
Well, that's incredible advice that you gave. And I think so much of that can be translated to today's military and leadership principles. And I know combat is so different than serving in a support role or someone who never sees combat like myself. I've never seen combat. I was in the Navy, but the leadership principles are the same. And there's so much that I drew from those three things that you said. And so I really appreciate you breaking those down. For those that are listening to the podcast that are not familiar with Vietnam and maybe only know the sanitized school-taught version of it, Tell us what you were experiencing out there as far as, you know, I've heard of the Viet Cong and the horrible things that they would, the traps that they would set up for American soldiers or whoever was coming through that was their enemy. So if you could talk us through what it was like being there and what you were up against, other than obviously the enemy trying to fire at you. I know there was so much more to it.
So again, terrain played a major factor in this. When you were out, when we were out in the more open areas, then booby traps became something really had to be cautious about. And the most common booby trap was an American hand grenade placed in an American sea ration can with a tripwire running across the trail. So the enemy somehow obtained American hand grenades and sea rations, which unfortunately we left behind in very frequently. And that was the most common form. And you'd be walking single file, and the tripwires would be little fine green wires. And the first two or three people might just step over it and miss it completely. But the third or the fourth person would hit the wire, pull the hand grenade out of the can, and it would explode and injure or kill several people in within a 15 meter radius. So that was the most common booby trap. You had to be very cautious about that. And we trusted our point man and the cover man to really constantly be looking down. And it was a difficult situation because if you were walking point, you wanted to see what was out in front of you. But at the same time, you had to be looking down and to see if there were trip wires or occasionally we found some punji pits. But most often booby trap was a hand grenade within a can.
What's the punji pits for those who don't know?
Well, those were sharpened bamboo stakes, sharpened to a very sharp point and then dipped in excrement so that if you stepped in, it wouldn't necessarily kill you but you would have the stick enter into your skin, would break the skin, and you know, because it had you'd come away with a tremendous infection. So and they would just be camouflaged little holes that you might step into.
And it's so different. I mean, there's similarities and there's differences between what you see today and in combat scenarios. I mean, I think a lot of people would compare them to IEDs, but at the same time, it's incredible to me to talk to anytime I talk to a combat veteran and how poised and how easily you can conversate about these really traumatic or what could be traumatic things. And I think a lot of it speaks to your training and the group of people that you're with. You keep talking about trust and trusting that person. And that's so important. It's so vital. But I also want to talk about how you mentally dealt with all this stuff to get to a point where today you can't talk about everything in such a poised manner, because I know a lot of Vietnam veterans, they really just don't talk about their experiences. And so I want to talk about mentally when you were there. And then also I want to transition that into you coming home from the war and then leading up to today and how you're able to talk about these experiences.
So there were really two wars going on in Vietnam. One was with the Viet Cong, and these were guerrillas. And when we found them, they were typically poorly armed. They would carry an AK-47 and maybe three or four magazines of ammunition and a little ball of rice. They didn't have uniforms. You know, they wore sandals. And then toward the Laotian border, that's where we were attempting to interdict regular North Vietnamese soldiers, and ideally large concentrations. That's what we were. We spent most of our time in the area adjacent to the Laotian border, attempting to prevent them from coming across the Ho Chi Minh Trail in large groups, and when we were able to interact with, interdict them, that's when the big firefights would occur. The other situations with the Viet Cong were small skirmishes. It might be three or four men. It might be just one. But when we hit, when we encountered regular North Vietnamese soldiers, it might be a platoon, a company, a regiment. And then, of course, the whole idea behind the first CAV was that you would engage that unit and then bring additional resources in by helicopter to completely disseminate the enemy force. So what we attempted to do in terms of my own leadership of these men, you know, I got just as scared as they did. There's no way not to be afraid when bullets start to go across your front or over your head. And everyone immediately hits the ground, hugs the ground, and starts to pray. But when that happens, all eyes, not necessarily literally, but figuratively, turn to the leader and say, you know, give us orders. Tell us what you want us to do. So we were trained, I was trained, to make decisions and to analyze the situation as quickly as possible and to make a decision and to give direction and give orders, right or wrong. And in training, that meant, you know, attacking the enemy. That was the objective. And we were measured, my success was measured by body count. But it became very clear to me that that probably wasn't a really smart strategy to follow, because you would find yourself out front attacking the enemy and not much support behind you. So that's where calling in additional resources became my standard practice, calling in artillery and helicopter gunships. But in deep jungle, they couldn't see the helicopter gunships. They couldn't see you on the ground. So they couldn't even if you hit pop smoke, they couldn't see the smoke. It would hang up in the canopy. So artillery was the typical method. But I guess for me, the thing that happened was that, I mean, John Wayne said it best. You know, he talked, and he never served in the service, by the way, but he was respected and revered by all soldiers. And he talked about fear, and he talked about courage, and he talked about that courage is being scared to death and saddling up anyway. And that's really what it was all about, to give orders and to try to not put your men in harm's way. And I tried very hard to do that, not to put my men in harm's way. Sometimes I had to, but I never intentionally risked their lives. Now, in writing the book, that was supposed to be a catharsis for me. That's why I intended it to be. And it took me 10 years to write the book because I had a family to raise. And I ended up writing it on, I had a job that took me on long airplane flights. So I would work on, I'd whip out my laptop as long as it wasn't too bumpy, and I'd work on a chapter. And then after I got a contract, it took me another year to rewrite, and had a wonderful proofreader who caught every misspelled word, every misplaced comma. And she asked a whole bunch of WTF questions. And I figured, well, if she didn't understand what I was talking about, then I needed to rewrite that section. But it turned out that writing the book was not a catharsis. And it brought back a lot of those pretty rough memories and memories that I had buried. And I think that's what a lot of soldiers do, especially if they've had some traumatic experiences. And most combat soldiers have had or did have traumatic experiences. I had a few. and I suffered from them. Interestingly, my PTSD didn't come out until about 20 years after I returned from Vietnam. It took 20 years, and I liken it to having a titanium steel trunk in the back of my mind, and I took all those horrendous experiences and I locked them away in that trunk. But after about 20 years, they started to leak out. And I didn't have nightmares per se, but I had daydreams, actual daydreams, where I relived some of these experiences. And it was really bothering me. I thought I was losing it. And fortunately, I had a good friend who I had helped. My civilian career was in publishing. So I helped this psychiatrist friend get her book published. And I went to see her and I said, okay, we'll have dinner, but tomorrow I want to have a session with you. And I explained what was going on with me. And she gave me some very simple exercises to practice. And I said, you've got to be kidding. It's that simple to overcome this? He said, yep, it's that simple. And I practiced those exercises and they didn't go away 100%, but I was able to cope with it and it didn't affect my day to day. So those are my two experiences with PTSD. One after 20 years, and then secondly, in writing the book, so much of that good, bad stuff floated back into my memories. And then I did have a few sleepless nights when those memories kept coming back to me. But I think talking about it, writing about it and talking about it over time, I mean, it's been 55 years. So the edges get a little bit softer. The memories aren't quite so intense. But I think it's the same sort of thing that, police and EMS people, anyone who's involved in traumatic situations experience, even emergency room physicians. And for me, I needed to talk about it and I needed to write about it. I needed to put it down on paper.
Well, I appreciate that you mentioned that it took 20 years for the PTSD to come through, because I think for some people, there's a misconception that PTSD is something that happens right away. And some people might feel that if it's 20 years later, which this does happen, I think to a lot of people, that the brain starts to recount certain things when maybe a certain trigger hits that we don't know about, or maybe it's just that time running its course and all of a sudden the brain just remembers something. And so a lot of people may feel that since it's been 20 years, it's not worth reopening those wounds and dealing with it. So thank you for sharing that part.
One of the interesting things when I was writing this book, my favorite author is Stephen King, and he wrote a book called On Writing. It's a wonderful book. It's not one of his horror stories. It's really about writing, and it's his story of how his first book, Carrie, was published. It's amazing, amazing book. But he talks about falling into his typewriter. And when I was on these airplane flights, working on my laptop, it was absolutely amazing what the detail that my mind retained. I would come away from writing on a chapter sweating. I could remember the detail in incredible details. I could see the colors. There was once or twice that I even smelled the smells. I know that sounds crazy, but it is just amazing how much detail your brain can retain.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited to get the chance to read through your book. And I hope that the listeners take the opportunity to also read that. I think there's so much that we can learn from history and from the recounts of people that have lived these things. So I'm so appreciative that you put your story into writing so that the generations to come will know what you went through and what war looked like back in the Vietnam era, because it really has changed so much. So when you came back from Vietnam, did you continue to serve stateside, or what, did you immediately separate from the military and then now you're a civilian?
Now, I was a regular Army officer, and I was scheduled to at 1 month before I was scheduled to leave Vietnam, an officer fills out a form called a dream sheet and put down where you would like to be assigned. And I didn't get orders, and I talked my boss into a trip to Saigon for 3 days to find out what my orders were. And after partying for a couple of days, I ended up in this giant gymnasium with low trays and 50,000 soldiers, each one with a punch card in the tray. And we went down the line alphabetically, and A to B to BAR to Bartlett Peter, Bartlett John. Here you are, Bartlett Robin. You're going to Fort Wainwright, APO Seattle. And I said, wait a minute, I lived in Seattle. There's no Fort Wainwright in Seattle. We had to get a directory and look it up. Fort Wainwright is in Fairbanks, Alaska. So I had put down that I wanted to be assigned to the West Coast. So I got the West Coast. So I spent about 2 weeks at home with my parents and got my car ready to go to Alaska, got uniforms and prepared, and then went to Fairbanks, Alaska for 2 years. And so I served for 6 years, for additional 4 years after I returned from Vietnam.
So how was that reintegration process for you? Not only returning stateside, but also once you separated from the military, did you find that you struggled with finding your place, I guess, for lack of a better term?
Well, you know, when you're in that military community, it's acknowledged what you went through. And many of the men that I served with, both in Alaska and then my subsequent assignment after that was back to Fort Benning, Georgia. They understood. We had, it was kind of a band of brothers, I guess you'd say. And we had very similar, many of us had very similar experiences. So that's a tight-knit community. I did not have any significant issues. My last duty assignment was at the leadership department of the infantry school. And I was put on a special group that was to prepare a course of instruction called Leadership for Professionals. That we trained the trainers. We brought in one officer and one sergeant from every unit throughout the entire world and trained the trainers in this leadership course that we developed. And we made overhead transparencies and a book of readings and a course outline and put the we developed a pretty much a college level course. And I said, hey, this is kind of interesting stuff. I like this. I like this publishing stuff. It's very neat. I think I'd like to work, because I had decided at that point in time I was going to get out of the service. And I went and interviewed with a whole bunch of publishing companies, textbook companies, and that's when I made the transition. And I ended up in Southern California working for Prentice Hall Publishing Company. And I will say at that point in time, it took me a good year to kind of get the military out of my system. And to this day, there's a lot of it still in my system. My wife says to me, your greatest strength is that you are fearless. And your greatest weakness is that you are fearless. So there's always a danger as a result of this training and the experiences that you have had or that I have had that your colleagues and managers have not. I worked for some managers that just had no clue whatsoever in terms of facing some of the real life situations that I have faced. I got a master's degree, and that helped a little bit. I guess it really comes down to street smarts. That I had a lot of street smarts and life smarts that many of my managers did not. And they may not have appreciated my interaction with them on occasion, which is a nice way of saying what you may assume. Yeah.
So you started the transition process into civilian life while you were still active, and then just kind of, it was more of a gradual process for you than just you're out one day and then now I'm deciding what to do next.
And I didn't encounter any protests. I was still in the military community. And in fact, my parents met my returning flight from Vietnam. And I said, how in the world did they ever figure out? Because there was no way I could tell them when I was going to come back. I could give them a rough approximation of several dates. But my father was an Air Force officer, and he got some connections, made some phone calls, and they ended up meeting practically every flight. And they figured out pretty soon they didn't need to meet the flights that had Marines on them. So that reduced the numbers. But they met every flight. And I landed at 11 o'clock at night at Travis Air Force Base, and I looked out the window, and there were two people standing outside a fence. And I said, those are my parents. And I got off that plane and I got within about 2 feet, because we were all dressed the same, right? I got within about 2 feet of my mother before she recognized me, and I kissed her through the fence. And so then, you know, I just went home with them, went back and had some leave. And like I said, I got ready to go to Alaska. That was my next trip, my next adventure.
That's so beautiful. I think sometimes people forget just how special those little things are. I wouldn't say that's a little thing, your parents going to every single flight waiting, because this is before social media, before cell phones. I mean, it took a little bit of legwork to do something like that. And that's really special that your parents were able to do that for you.
I should mention, I was 22 years old when I went over to Vietnam, and I came back, I was 23 years old. So I'm still pretty young guy.
You know, we think in our 20s that we're grown, but
invincible.
Yeah. Well, that's so cool. And I'm so grateful that you shared that. And there's so many lessons that can be taken on so many different forefronts from your story that I think could be applied to people today. And so thank you for sharing so many of these pieces and sharing so many parts of your story, both in Vietnam and outside of Vietnam. And so is there anything you would have changed?
I wouldn't have done it.
Really?
I would not have done it. When I got out of the service, because I wanted to become, again, I was a regular Army officer, and I went to the Office of Personnel Operations, and I said to him, here's what I would like to do. I'd like to go to Germany and be a military attaché. That was my next station. They said, well, we'll talk about that when you come back from your second tour in Vietnam. And I said, wait a minute, I've got two Purple Hearts. I have no desire whatsoever to go. And if they sent me back, I'd go back either as a company commander, or what they had in mind was to send me to the Monterey Language Institute, teach me to speak Vietnamese, and send me as a Vietnamese unit advisor. Well, if there was one job that was worse than being a combat infantry platoon leader, it was being a Vietnamese unit advisor. And I said, nah, that's not what I want to do. They said, well, this is how we have you programmed. And that was the wrong thing to say to me. I just said, nope, I'm not going to be programmed. And they said, well, take the weekend and think it over. This is what we have you programmed for. So I did. I took the weekend, thought it over, came back, called my father, said, nope, this is not for me. I came back, met with this major who was an armor officer. And I'm going, why in the world is an armor officer counseling an infantry officer? He had no combat experience. Anyway, he said, well, look, Captain Bartlett, here the Army has spent all this money to move you and your family from Alaska to Georgia. Well, I was a bachelor. Everything I owned fit in my car. He hadn't even looked at my records. He said, we're going to go ahead and send you down to Georgia and they'll find a job for you. You can be an instructor or something. And for the first time, I just kept my mouth shut. And I said, that sounds good. I'll do that. And he said, well, if you change your mind, we'll reprogram you for the next adventure. And that really was the turning point for me. I would not, my whole philosophy has that war just was something we should not have escalated the way we did. It was wrong. And our commanders and our leaders, our civilian leaders, lied to us and caused unnecessary loss of life and a prolongment of the war. It just, you know, the truth is out now about that war. But no American president wanted to be classified as the first American president to lose a war. So they just kept putting more troops out there and extending the battle right to the very end.
So it sounds like there was a bit of moral injury there too.
Absolutely.
With you and in your service.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. Thank you. Really not the answer I expected, honestly, because I think when you hear someone join ROTC during a war period, and this is me just connecting the dots with a lot of the 9/11 combat vets that I talked to, a lot of them joined the military specifically because of something that was happening, i.e. 9/11. And so understanding that obviously Vietnam was a completely different time period. It's interesting to see why different people join the service and if you would have done anything differently. So I'm definitely going to do more reading up on Vietnam now because it's been a while, but history is just so powerful to me. And it's something that I love to dig into. And I love talking to people who lived through it. So I have so much gratitude. I know I keep saying it. I have so much gratitude for you sharing your experiences and your story. And I
would also just mention that another major changing point for me was my platoon was ambushed by a North Vietnamese unit, and I lost four men, and another three of us were wounded, myself included. My wounds were shrapnel wounds. They were not too severe, but I was bleeding pretty profusely, and I was knocked out. So my squad leader fortunately pulled me back, but I had blood on my chest and on my groin from the shrapnel wounds, and I was knocked out. So they thought I was dead, and they put me in the dead pile. And then I woke up, but by that time I'd lost a lot of blood, and I sat up, but then I fainted because I had lost a lot of blood. And the second time I groaned, and somebody said, hey, he's not dead. And then they were able to, stop the bleeding. But this was happened at late at night. Night firefights were always the worst. And I couldn't get a medevac in till about 6 o'clock the next morning. So I lay there on the ground, and my squad leader kept coming over and slapping me in the face because he didn't want me we had no blood expanders or anything, but he didn't want me to pass out and he didn't want me to go into shock. So he kept slapping me in the face, and I told him to stop it. But during that time, I had a long talk with myself and decided that if I should die right at that point in time, it just was not worth it. I had more to accomplish with my life, and what I had done or what I was doing was not, it just was not the right thing for my life and for my future.
Yeah.
So that was also a major turning point for me as well.
And no pain medication when this happened? Or did they at least give you something?
No pain medication.
Oh my goodness. Wow, you are tough. I can see what your wife is saying.
I had a
now.
Bad headache.
Oh, I'm sure you did. Wow. Well, you've been through quite the experiences. What do you want the rest of your life to look like? Or at least the next 5 years? We'll go next 5 years.
Well, right now I'm having perhaps the best work experience that I've ever had. I'm working for my college doing fundraising. And my job is to call senior alumni from my college and chat them up, talk with them about the school and all that's happening at the school. They bring me back once a year to get up to speed on all of the things that are happening and the programs that are running and the various different funds. And so when I talk to these senior alumni, I bring them up to date on what's going on. And then I get them to reach into their pocket and write me a check or write the college a check. So it's a wonderful experience. I get to talk to, you know, relive very similar types of experiences, tell them stories, and they appreciate my phone call much more so than somebody, a younger college student, because yeah, we have more in common.
That's awesome. And so where can people find you if they want to grab a copy of your book or they just want to follow your journey?
So if they'd like to get an autographed copy with free shipping and save $13 off the cover price, they can just come to my website. And I have a very, very robust website with lots of information. Got some wonderful videos up and photographs, a lot of photographs. And all my blogs are there and past speaking engagements. And the website is www.robinbartlettauthor.com. Or they can just Google Robin Bartlett writer. And I've done so many podcasts that they'll find me right away.
Awesome. Well, I will link that in the show notes. And I hope that every single person that listens to this podcast grabs a copy, because your story, even the just the snippets that I've heard on this interview, it's incredible. And I hope you acknowledge yourself for that, because you have been through a lot and you've overcame a lot and you have an incredible journey.
I'd like to add one last note. And that is, you know, these days, the Vietnam veterans are starting to walk in the boots of our very, very few World War II vets left and the Korean vets. And typically you see them wearing their baseball caps, Vietnam veteran type of baseball caps. And the typical greeting is thank you for your service. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with saying that. It's a wonderful greeting. But if you really want to make an impression on a Vietnam veteran and you bring tears to their eyes and lumps to their throat, you say the words, this is the code words, welcome home. Say welcome home and watch the reaction. It's a game changer.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today, with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.